The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to send us your emails this week, as we hope to get into those in the next day or two. Send those to td@kpcg.fm. Well, in Germany, it's gone from bad to worse for Chancellor Merkel. Now it appears that when Mrs. Merkel opened Germany's borders last year to more than a million refugees, that action may have been unconstitutional, according to a report headed up by a group in Bavaria. I'll get into that in just a bit. There's another report coming out of Germany, a law enforcement report, about the crime wave sweeping across the nation, Germany, and how it's being fueled by criminals coming from North Africa. Of course, we've talked a lot over the last week about that case of mass sexual molestations on New Year's Eve in Cologne, but also, as we now are seeing, there are quite a few cases in other cities, not just in Germany, in Europe. As I say, I'll get to that as well. In just a moment. Let me first, though, start with this piece. It's in the Telegraph today, or yesterday, I guess. Written by a woman, Jessica McCallan, whose blunt headline says it all: too many Muslim men are misogynists. She talks from personal experience. She writes here, in 1993, this is in the Telegraph today, when I was 17, in 1993, when I was 17 and my sister, my sisters were 12 and 11, our family moved to the Turkish capital, Ankara, because of my father's job with the UN. For the next 2 years, we were leered at, she's talking about her and her sisters, teenagers, preteens. We were leered at, jeered at, hissed at, groped, and touched. Again and again and again, every single time we left the house. The only time this treatment lessened was if we went out with my father. Once I was groped and hit in the face right outside the president's palace. The guards responded by hooting and laughing and shoving their pelvises at me. So this is what these three girls were subjected to in that Turkish city. It brought to mind incidents that I can remember in the little nation of Jordan, the moderate nation, many would say, from back in the late 1990s, when we had some of our own female volunteers who went through similar experiences. One in particular who was groped when we were on a field trip down in the south of Jordan. McCallan continues, of course, not all Muslim men behave this way. Not all Muslim societies allow such misogynistic behavior. I have never been insulted by, say, a sub-Saharan African Muslim or an Indonesian. But the confluence of certain cultural mores with particular interpretations of Islam and particular understandings about Western women can produce the toxic brew that I've experienced. For example, when we were in Turkey, dark-haired Western women suffered significantly less harassment, and we concluded that this was happening because we were pale and blonde. Male Muslim friends later confirmed that many of their peers consider all Western women whores, but associate this most strongly with blonde women. Why? We are rarer, more distinct from, quote-unquote, their women, and still highly objectified in our own societies. They associate us with the peroxide performers they see involved in sexual acrobatics and pornographic films and assume this is an accurate portrayal of who we are. And so for, as she's pointing out here, for many young men growing up in Islamic societies, this is just the way that they come to view Western women, particularly blonde women. Now she goes on to discuss, again, the mass sexual molestations in Germany and how that the police in Cologne tried to conceal the ethnicity of the attackers and how that the city mayor, a woman, suggested to the women of Germany to keep their distance. And of course that led to an outcry in response. This lady, McAllen, continues in her piece, I gave up talking to people about how I was treated by Muslim men a long time ago. Most became uncomfortable, muttered things about cultural sensitivity, and accused me of racism. Yet Islam is not a race, it's a religion, a belief system, a set of cultural constructs and values that are open to interpretation and change. Being white, blonde, and female, on the other hand, are constants. Finally, it says here, naturally, the West is not always a bastion of sexual equality and respect, but in my experience, the worst examples of misogyny do come from Muslim societies, and disproportionate numbers of Muslim men hold misogynist views. So while we must respect the plight of refugees, I have rights too, she says. So do those German women, who were, in my view, subjected to hate crime. Hundreds of them. Groped. Several evidently raped. On that night of partying, out on the streets of Germany, with these packs of Muslim men, many of them coming from North Africa. What a clash of cultures. And of course, you have the multiculturalists in Europe. They're stuck between a rock and a hard place. They obviously want freedom for modern women, feminists, to be able to move about throughout Europe without fear of being groped or molested. But then also many of these multiculturalists, they want the flow of immigrants to continue. Well, we know, as I covered with you yesterday, we know that it's all building to the fulfillment of Daniel 11 and verse 40, this clash between Europe and between radical Islam. All of this too, together with other crises, it's clearing the way for the Daniel 8 strongman to appear. As I said there at the top, for Chancellor Merkel, it's going from bad to worse. Notice this headline. This is from the Times today. North African crime wave hits Merkel. That's who it's hitting, Merkel. It says the high level of crime committed by North Africans in Germany has been revealed as Angela Merkel asked Algeria to... for help to speed up extraditions after the New Year's Eve attacks. 40% of migrants from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia committed a crime within a year of arriving in Germany. 40% within 1 year. And so throughout the year, last year, what was it, 1.1 million refugees? And that's what this new study is finding. That within a year, 40% of them will commit some kind of criminal act. It says the analysis came from police records in Cologne, where 516 complaints have been made after mob violence and sex attacks on women New Year's Eve. later on in this Times article. It says Mrs. Merkel, under huge pressure to show that she can keep Germans safe, appealed to the Algerian prime minister for help, speeding up extraditions when he visited Berlin yesterday. It says here she faces the threat of court action. So here's another problem. She faces the threat of court action from allies in her own conservative coalition to close Germany's borders. The Christian Social Union Party, which runs the state of Bavaria and has three seats in the national cabinet, obtained legal advice that there was no unlimited obligation to take refugees, as Mrs. Merkel has insisted. The chancellor has steadfastly refused to talk of limits to asylum seekers. And so this party, the Christian Social Union, is now getting legal advice that the law is on their side. They're the ones saying the borders need to be closed, or at least that the flow of refugees should be restricted. This article from NTV, it's a German source. It was translated by our own news bureau in Edmond, talking about this legal examination, what the German law actually says. It says here, after a legal examination of the current immigration crisis, constitutional expert Udo De Fabio comes to a shocking result. The federal government is breaking clear constitutional law with its refusal to comprehensively control the country's borders. And so it appears to be a case very similar to the United States, where there are laws on the books, but they're just not followed. They're disregarded. It says the report states that the federal government is, out of constitutional reasons, obligated to reestablish effective control of the federal borders if the common European immigration and border security systems are temporarily or permanently impaired. It refers later on in the piece to Free State of Bavaria had commissioned the controversial report in order to clarify whether or not Merkel's government was still based on the foundation of law. In light of De Fabio's report, Merkel's policy looks like a continued breach of the law. The critics should be even louder toward the chancellor, who has snapped her fingers and set the existing EU legislation out of place, proclaiming her own rules of morality. This is true for other European countries, it says, which are increasingly outraged over Merkel's way of exceptions. Now those who accuse Merkel of triggering a crisis of the rule of law will be strengthened, as it has possibly caused a chain reaction of law-breaking, eventually culminating in the Cologne attacks. And so it draws a clear line between these unconstitutional policies and then these mass attacks that have happened in recent weeks. Can you even believe that less than a year ago, Chancellor Merkel was one of the most popular leaders in the world? Certainly in Germany. And look at what has happened. In less than 1 year. Even if you go back 6 or 7 months, we're looking at a very different Germany. We're looking at a very different Europe. Yesterday, there was another suicide bombing in Istanbul coming from the Islamic State, I guess. I don't know if it's laid claim to that attack yet or not, but in any event, it killed 10 vacationers, 9 of them coming from Germany. Here's Germany connected to another tragic event. Germans make up about 20% of the tourists in Turkey. But look at what's happened in recent years, particularly in the last year with the refugee crisis. People streaming into Turkey from Syria and Iraq, and then from there on into Europe. The Times of London says Angela Merkel said that at least another 9 Germans were injured in the explosion, some of them seriously. She called for decisive action against international terrorism and said that her thoughts were with the families of the victims. And then it quotes Merkel saying, "We must recognize that today it hit Istanbul. It has hit Paris. It has hit Tunisia. It has also hit Ankara already. So international terrorism showed once again its cruel and inhuman face." She says, "In addition to the sorrow we feel today, it again shows the necessity to continue to take decisive action against terrorism and ultimately to overcome these atrocities." That's what the German chancellor said yesterday in response to this attack on Istanbul. I mean, Turkey's gone from a popular tourist destination for so many Europeans to a country that's just been marred by one terrorist atrocity after another. If ISIS was in fact behind it, this would be their 3rd suicide bombing attack on Turkish soil in 6 months. Look at Europe. Look at the crises. Look at Germany. Well, look too at the Middle East. Turkey is finally waking to the fact that it's got to clamp down on border security, its own border security. Of course, it's been urged to do so by the West, but now it's seeing it's got to do so just for its own safety, just for the safety of its own people. And so it's a little bit more difficult for ISIS fighters to get into Syria, just because the most popular route to this point has been to go through Turkey. And so this piece here, this is from the Washington Free Beacon, it says ISIS shifts to Libya. There's other territory, there's other ground to conquer. The Free Beacon says the Islamic State terror group is making significant gains in Libya, as hundreds of its members have been detected moving there from Syria and Iraq in recent weeks amid stepped-up bombing and tighter border controls. U.S. intelligence agencies have identified at least 500 ISIS fighters over the past 2 months moving into the war-torn North African state that became an Al-Qaeda safe haven following, keep in mind why this happened, following the ouster of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. And you'll remember what America was saying when that happened. Oh, this is going to be great for Libya. This is great for the people of Libya. They finally have a voice. They can finally choose their own government. And what we've seen there in the 4 years since is chaos. A terrorist safe haven. And now ISIS expanding its footprint. Notice this interesting little nugget within the Free Beacon piece. It says Germany's military is considering a training mission for the Libyan army, according to Der Spiegel. Up to 200 troops of the Bundeswehr, as the German military is called, could be sent to Tunisia within the next few months to train Libyan soldiers and counter the spread of ISIS fighters. It says the German military is currently training Kurdish fighters in northern Iraq, and the Libyan mission would be similar. Here again, we have another, well, this article referred to the Spiegel piece, which I believe was in German originally, and our news bureau translated parts of that as well. It says that in addition to the recent military involvement in Syria and Mali, The Bundeswehr is now considering undertaking a new mission abroad beginning in the next few months. German soldiers, together with their Italian comrades, plan to begin training the Libyan militia. Spiegel reported, due to safety concerns in the region, the mission will ultimately take place in Libya's neighboring country, Tunisia, and would likely include 150 to 200 German soldiers. And then it talks about how the Bundeswehr is stepping up its actions to fight against ISIS. So many of these stories coming out of Europe, you see this strong link to Germany. They're all impacting Germany. It's not only putting a massive amount of pressure on Angela Merkel, but it's making Germany, the German army, much more aggressive, much more offensive-minded. Whether it's in Libya or Syria or Iraq or Mali or wherever. And meanwhile, in the United States, I mean, we've just seen years of withdrawal and retreat. We've seen years of appeasement. We see America projecting weakness at every turn. This is a statement from the State of the Union address last night. Just pretty much floored me. You look at what's happened to America's standing in the world these past several years, and yet in listening to President Obama, you would think that America's position is stronger than ever. Here's what the president said last night.
I told you earlier, all the talk of America's economic decline is political hot air. Well, so is all the rhetoric you hear about our enemies getting stronger and America getting weaker. Let me tell you something. The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth. Period. Period. It's not even close. It's not even close. It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined. Our troops are the finest fighting force in the history of the world. No nation attacks us directly or our allies because they know that's the path to ruin. Surveys show our standing around the world is higher than when I was elected to this office, and when it comes to every important international issue, people of the world do not look to Beijing or Moscow to lead. They call us.
They may call the United States, but the United States hasn't been answering. In Syria, in Ukraine, in Libya. Go right down the list. And surveys show that America's standing is higher than ever. Surveys. Wow. Look at these last 7 years. America was so weak with respect to Syria that we basically had to ask Russia to take over. We left Ukraine high and dry. We've pretty much left the Middle East. Well, of course, now there's some action against ISIS. But that was after the evacuation of Iraq that gave rise to the Islamic State. And then look at Saudi Arabia forming its own regional coalition to oppose Iran. Because when it came calling to America, America said, no, take care of it yourself. And while the U.S. may have a huge military budget, where's that money going? What are we spending it on? It's not on the Navy, that's for sure. As of right now, the U.S. has 272 ships less than half of what it was decades ago under the Reagan era. It's down 13 just since 2009, just in the last 6-7 years. Losing one or two ships a year. There was a plan. After it dipped so low, there was a plan to at least get it back up to 308. That's been abandoned. That's been abandoned. Even though we spend so much money, evidently. This is from Seth Cropsey, the director of the Hudson Institute's Center of American Sea Power. He says Secretary of Defense Ash Carter's plan implies that the deterrent effect of a constant U.S. presence in the world is less important. I mean, this is the approach. This is the strategy. We don't need a deterrent effect. It's not as important. It's less important than the Navy's ability to fight and win wars with the advanced weapons he favors. That assumption, this individual writes, is mistaken. We need both the ability to be present, which demands more ships than we have, and the related power to win a war if deterrence doesn't work. Even the Navy's now endangered plan for 308 ships was far below the approximately 350 combat ships needed to achieve this aim. And so everywhere you look, you see downsizing. You see the military being hollowed out. And meanwhile, China's Navy is increasing rapidly. They're building aircraft carriers in the South China Sea. Well, they just announced they're going to build an actual, literal aircraft carrier. That's a huge announcement just coming a couple of weeks ago. Is the U.S. power being challenged? What did he say there at one point? No nation dares to attack us or our allies because they know that that's the path to ruin. He said that 2 hours after Iran seized two of our U.S. Navy patrol boats. Took 10 prisoners. 10 crew members hostage. No nation dares to attack the mighty United States. That's pretty amazing. The level of blindness. This statement also stood out last night where he talked about maybe one of the regrets he's had while in office. Here's what he said.
It's one of the few regrets of my presidency that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. I have no doubt a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office.
This is one of the few regrets that he has. And as Richard Palmer was pointing out to me this morning when we were discussing this part of the speech, it's amazing when you think of how this administration is responsible for so much of this rancor and suspicion, for so much of this division. This is the most radically left president in history. And yet you listen to those smooth-sounding words. It's like Richard Palmer said, it's very similar, some strong parallels there with what happened in the Worldwide Church of God after Herbert Armstrong died in 1986. I went through some of that history with you yesterday. And all of the sweet-sounding words. We heard them again during the 6 years of litigation. The lawsuit over Mystery of the Ages and the other works of Herbert Armstrong. As one of their ministers after another came before those lawyers during depositions and talked about how innocent and how smooth everything had been and how they just had all these wonderful intentions. if there's any regrets, it's that those on the far right, the ultra-conservatives, the ones who won't change, if only they could have come more over to the middle so that we could have more unity. He said later, the president did, the world will look to us to help solve these problems, and our answer needs to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. That may work as a TV soundbite, but it doesn't pass muster on the world stage. That's a bit of a criticism aimed at some of those on the right. Those evil conservatives. Yeah, they may have some good sound bites, but what they have, it doesn't pass muster on the world stage. That's what I have. I can bring the world together. I know how to reach out to world leaders. I know how to bring the nations together. It all sounds so nice. It sounds like everything's going great in the world. Is it? Is it going great? This will be an interesting year for sure. Right now, I mean, Donald Trump's getting a lot of the attention within the Republican camp. But you don't want to overlook what's happening on the other side, particularly in this current administration that has at least 1 year left. Hillary Clinton's campaign appears to be imploding. You've got Bernie Sanders, the rabid socialist, rising in the polls in Iowa, South Carolina. And then, as I say, the current administration in the White House now working hard on its mission to fundamentally transform the United States. Well, there's going to be a lot to keep track of, both in the United States and Europe. Here in the UK as well. A couple of stories I had to set aside. There's just not enough time to cover everything. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. Right there in Edmond, Oklahoma, our headquarters campus. This broadcast comes to you from Edstone in the UK, the sister campus of our headquarters operation. The live stream for this station is at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Yesterday, I previewed our TV program scheduled to play this weekend, the 30th anniversary weekend of Herbert Armstrong's death. It's titled The Destruction of a Religious Empire. It talks a lot about the painful history of that transition from Mr. Armstrong's era to the Takaches, who took over the reins of government and destroyed everything that Mr. Armstrong had built. That story is discussed in Raising the Ruins. That's the book that we advertise on this particular program. So we're certainly anticipating a big response. We're certainly praying for a big response. Last year, by the way, our average responses, it kept going up as the year progressed because we did add those two stations in the middle of the year. But overall, for 52 weeks, the average response was 104, just a little over 100 per week, calling or texting this church, requesting the literature that was offered. So far this year, we only have 2 weekends to work with, but so far this year, the average has been 155. So from 104 to 155, that represents good growth. And hopefully that's an average, 155. That's an average that we can continue to bump upward. So let's at least get up over 155 this weekend. I think having seen the program yesterday, however, it's the kind of program that could generate more than that. We'll just have to wait and see. Well, on yesterday's show, I referred to some of that history from back in 1990, 1991, when so many of those WCG leaders, so many of those ministers that took over after Mr. Armstrong died, and after they changed all the doctrines and stopped all the programs that Mr. Armstrong had started and sold off all the assets and hoarded all the money, that's what basically set the stage for the mustard seed beginning of the Philadelphia Church of God in late 1989. Started so small, two ministers, low-ranking ministers from the Midwest, four families, 12 people, no budget to work with, no money to speak of. And boy, did those leaders in the Worldwide Church of God have a good time with that. They laughed, they ridiculed, they mocked this work. They said it, they likened it, one of them did, they likened it to a peanut shell floating around on the ocean without direction, going nowhere. Well, it did start small, there's no doubting that. But it started on a sure foundation, because these were a few people who really did stand fast, as it says there in 2 Thessalonians 2:15. A few people who were holding to the traditions which they had been taught. They were standing firm in the truth. They were proclaiming God's warning message. They were sending out Malachi's message to God's church today, even if it was just an inexpensive manuscript at the time. The words printed on those pages, revelation from God. What a strong warning. If you back up, I don't think I read this verse yesterday. This is 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 14. The verse right before it says to stand fast in the traditions which you've been taught. Right before that it says, whereunto he called you by our gospel to the obtaining of the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's connected to the true gospel of Jesus Christ. This truth, these traditions, that we're to stand fast. That we're to stand fast in. God really wants us to keep that gospel message pure. He wants us to stay grounded in those pure instructions. Those revealed truths, those revealed teachings. Let's just look over at Amos 9. The prophecy here at the end of the book of Amos. Get your Bible and read along with me. see what God has to say about this work. This work that you're supporting. This work that you're so interested in. This work that you want to tune into. This work that you want to stand fast in. It says here in Amos 9 and verse 11, "In that day I'll raise up the tabernacle of David that has fallen and close up the breaches thereof, and I'll raise up his ruins, and I'll build it as in the days of old." Well, it's been over 26 years since my father was fired for standing up for the truth. But look at what God has raised up in those 26 years. And then you compare it with what's happened to the worldwide church of God. That's why we've got to be well aware of our history in raising the ruins. I wrote, even in the early days of the PCG, my father said this scripture, this one here in Amos 9, he said it was a prophecy that the work built by Herbert Armstrong would be turned to ruins and that we would then raise it back up. God wanted to replicate the way things were done in the days of old. And so here we come with a message and a focus that's really not that complicated, is it? It's about raising the ruins. It's about building as in the days of old. So if we know our history, if we're grounded in Mystery of the Ages, if we know that history in the autobiography of Herbert Armstrong, we're going to know a lot about how to build for God. 12 people in 1990, and a little book, a manuscript. And then a couple months after that, a little newsletter that became the Philadelphia Trumpet, that became the Trumpet Magazine. And a little while after that, a year or two, a radio broadcast that became the Key of David program, the television program. It went from radio in 92 to TV in 1993. And the Philadelphia Church of God started to grow. More and more people in the worldwide Church of God. By 1993, by 1994, by 1994, I mean, they just completely came out of the closet. Everything's changed. The law's done away. Sabbath keeping, not necessary. You don't need to even tithe to God. Nothing. Well, that led to a lot of people leaving for other organizations too, as there were quite a few back then who said, well, just leave and go anywhere else, basically, other than the Philadelphia Church of God, because, well, they're too conservative. They're too extreme. They're too radical. And yet the PCG grew and grew. It's still a small organization, comparatively speaking. But look at the fruits. In 1996, we started printing Mystery of the Ages. I should have brought that inspiring quote from my father, who said, hey, we're going to print it and distribute it and deal with the consequences and face them, face whatever they may be, because this is what God wants. Well, there was some intense litigation that followed from 1997 all the way through to 2003. 6 years. More than 6 years. And during that time, right in the middle of that 6 years, we purchased 160 acres in North Edmond, made the decision to start a college. The college doors opened in 2001. Small beginnings, of course, all along the way, just 8 students at the beginning. And then the court case victory in 2003, and the fact that we owned the copyrights. That was hard to even imagine. when we first printed them. When we first printed them, we just said, copyright Herbert Armstrong. He wrote it. It's his works. By the end of it, we were able to own those copyrights. Mystery of the Ages, The Incredible Human Potential, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, The Correspondence Course, all those booklets, Who and What is the Prophetic Beast, and on and on and on it goes. The Sabbath booklet. All of that literature. A year or so after that, we had our big mail processing facility completed. Then the Hall of Administration, 2005, I think it was. 2006, our first crop of seniors, graduates from Armstrong College. That same year, our first group heading over to Jerusalem. To Jerusalem, to dig with Dr. Elat Mazar, the distinguished Israeli archaeologist. That's saying something for a little peanut shell. The digs there in the City of David, 2006, 2007, 2008. In 2008, we broke ground on the Armstrong Auditorium. Finished that a couple of years later. Brought in the Jeremiah Seals exhibit in 2011. Went back strong for more digs in 2012 and 13. On the Ophel this time. There was the gold medallion. Of course, here recently, Hezekiah's bulla. And then more recently, too, you know all about Edstone. We were working there in 2012 and 13 to try to get a portion or a small chunk of Brickett Wood, the old campus that Mr. Armstrong had. God wanted us here at Edstone, and we made that purchase. What is it, 22 acres, I guess it is? That happened in 2014, the establishment of the sister campus in 2015. This very radio station got its start in 2015, and you could just go on and on and on. You could add a lot more detail to this story. It all started like the tiny mustard seed. That's the way it started for Mr. Armstrong when he was rolling off those plain truth sheets on that old mimeograph machine. That was the early 1930s. But look at the work in 1986. Verse 12, here in Amos 9, it says that they may possess the remnant of Edom and of all the heathen which are called by my name, says the Eternal that does this, that they may possess or own the remnant. My father said in 2001 that must include Mystery of the Ages and Mr. Armstrong's other books and booklets. He said that in 2001. And when did we win the lawsuit? When did we obtain all those copyrights? In 2003, 2 years later. But before that, well before that, he looked at this verse and said, well, possess says possess. I guess we're going to own them. How could we have known that in 2001? How could he have gone out on a limb like that? At the time, in 2001, the Worldwide Church had every possible advantage in court. All they had to do was ride it out, and we would have paid damages and lost. But there was a very different outcome that God had in mind. You can read all about that in Raising the Ruins. God wanted us to have ownership. And all this is connected to building, raising those ruins. In the book I wrote in Amos 9, God says possessing those many books, and booklets coincides directly with the work of raising the ruins that were built before Mr. Armstrong died. Of course, as with everything God builds through human beings, it started incredibly small. It started like a mustard seed. But look at where it leads. Look at where the growth is headed. Look at what can happen in 26 years. Now project ahead and think, well, what about 100 years or 200 years? What about a millennium? Verse 13, it says, "Behold, the days come, says the Eternal, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes, him that sows seed, and the mountains shall drop sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. And I'll bring again the captivity of my people of Israel, and they shall build the waste cities." This is a millennial passage. Talk about raising the ruins. "They shall build the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof. They shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them. And I'll plant them upon their land, and they shall no more be pulled up out of their land, which I have given them, says the Eternal your God." That's where this work that you support, that you're listening into, that's where this work is leading. That's where it's headed. It leads right into the wonderful world tomorrow. God doesn't want us to ever plateau. He doesn't want us ever to get to thinking that, well, it's just, I think we've about accomplished all that we can. Now we just want to kind of maintain things. God says, you hold on to those traditions. Hang on to that truth. But more than that, you dispense with it. You distribute these works. You give it to others. He wants us thinking about building and expanding, possessing those publications, those books and booklets. It's tied right together with raising the ruins. It's tied right together with building for God. And so we build. And so we build. We dispense with God's message. We proclaim the truth of God. We freely offer everything that we have to anyone who will listen and take an interest. It's not an easy way of life by any means. It's the straight and narrow way. But how satisfying it is, how rewarding it is, what blessings it brings into your life. If you hold on to what you were taught, if you hold on to those traditions, and really get busy building for God. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. The live stream is at kpcg.fm. Send in those emails, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.